You've come here with a film called Containment, which is all about how you contain nuclear waste for 10,000 years. An odd topic for a film? What inspired you?
Precisely how weird that description sounds. You come across this idea that, well, in fact, it was a practical question, that before the particular waste site in the United States, the waste isolation pilot plant in southern New Mexico, could be opened, the federal government said, before you open this, you have to design a marking system that will communicate with people over the next 10,000 years to convince them not to dig in that particular place. And it's a question that arises out of our production of nuclear materials. It's a kind of outsized question. It's a kind of ridiculous question because 10,000 years is longer than recorded human history. It's a kind of question that provokes what we are as human beings. It provokes us to think about things in ways that we're not really set up to do. But it's a practical question because we've created the stuff and we have to figure out what to do with it.
So you filmed at the WIPP site. You also filmed at Fukushima, and you also looked at these various scenarios of how you create markers to warn people about the site, didn't you?
So there's three sites in the film. And the origin of the idea came from this, you know, how do you mark nuclear waste for 10,000 years? But once we started with that question, that led us to the WIPP site in southern New Mexico. And we got down into the WIPP site, into this underground mine where they're putting transuranic waste, waste that's left over in the production of nuclear weapons. And that led us to another site in the United States called the Savannah River site, where they made maybe 40% of the plutonium used for atomic bombs during the Cold War period. And that production produced a huge amount of nuclear waste. It's very eerie. You go to the Savannah River site and you're walking over, underneath you are 51 1-million-gallon tanks filled with 39 million gallons of nuclear waste. And that waste was meant to stay there temporarily, like all nuclear waste is where it is now, is because it was there temporarily, mostly. And they're now slowly getting out of these tanks. They were meant to be there for 5 years. They're in these tanks that were meant to be temporary. The tanks themselves are starting to corrode. The stuff is very difficult. The production of nuclear power, the production of nuclear weapons, was done in a kind of rush, a kind of perceived national security rush.
It's part of the Cold War.
Part of the Cold War. And there was even then an understanding that the waste issues would have to be dealt with, but just not now. But the just not now part turns out to be forever, in human lifetime terms, a kind of forever. And it's now we're having to figure it out because the places where they're being kept are no longer safe, if they ever were. We have to come up with a kind of national and international consensus of what to do with this stuff. This stuff's very dangerous. It lasts for a very long time. The kinds of technical and ethical problems are difficult to contend with, and we wanted the film to address these problems.
Did you have difficulty getting permission to film at some of these sites?
Outrageously difficult problems getting permission to film. Nobody wanted us to film, even in Japan. But, you know, in the United States, the nuclear waste sites are government-owned, but they're company-operated. So there's two levels of bureaucracy to get through. That turned out to be maybe good for us because the companies are not interested at all in us coming to film. But the government has a mixture of wanting to be open and, you know, understanding that this is taxpayers' money and that they have a responsibility to be transparent. I mean, they have other impulses as well. But we were able to ride the freedom of information part of the government and worked our way into these sites.
You managed to have an interview with the director of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as well.
Two.
Yeah. Was that hard to do?
Yes, we talked to two chairs of the NRCs in the United States, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This is the governing body of things nuclear. Greg Jasko and Allison McFarland, successively. And they were willing to talk to us. They devoted a great deal of their lives to thinking about nuclear issues. They were aware, as we were aware, that nuclear waste is something that people don't think about, that it's not a kind of idea that's disseminated amongst the public. It's not something the public's really thinking about. Yet the public has to be involved in making these big decisions because it's a kind of idea that doesn't just reside in any local way. Like, if you're going to get, and this is one of the central parts of the film and one of the things I'm most passionate about, is that if you're going to decide to put nuclear waste somewhere, You have to really deal in a democratic way with the complexities of what getting consent means. And that means many things in different environments, and among them, the people living closest to the site. But then there's also how the waste gets to the site. And then there's the fact that if nuclear waste gets into the biosphere, then it's not just the local community that's affected, it's nearby communities. Then there's the bigger ethical responsibilities about why is it cited there and who agreed to put it there. All of these things are reflections on our ability to function democratically. Anything nuclear pushes us in ways that are difficult for our kind of democratic impulses to survive. There's lots of money to be made, so you're dealing with corporate interests which want to frame the argument in a certain way that's interested in profit. But, you know, it's not like profit in itself, well, maybe it is, but is not necessarily unethical, although it certainly can be. If it's framed in such a way so that it excludes other thoughts, it becomes unethical.
Mm. Well, certainly the nuclear industry prefers not to discuss waste if it can avoid it, and it certainly has a lot of money. Are there problems there in terms of a lot of money affecting democratic decision-making?
There's no doubt that money affects democratic decision-making in almost every arena. It's one of the great tensions in our democracy between the impulse to the bottom line and the impulse to democratic principles. And we just have to be, it's not that that's going to go away anytime soon, and so there's no sense avoiding it, but it's worth thinking about. In the nuclear realm, it really is a question of how you define the problems, let alone the solution. So, if you think about nuclear, the problems with nuclear, for example, nuclear power, just at the level of producing electricity once the plant is built, not counting mining of uranium or the milling of uranium, not counting the waste issues, just the thing itself, then you can say, well, it has a less of a carbon footprint, it's not that expensive. There's things that you can say that are, you know, make it seem as if it's a good idea. But if you don't include the entire process, then you're not actually taking the problem seriously. And you just need all of the information on the table. The communities have to be able to engage the entire process that's on the table, to think about things openly and transparently, be able to make their feelings felt, and then people can make whatever decision they want.
You also filmed in Japan, in Fukushima. Were there difficulties getting permissions to film there?
Japan is a very organized society, but nothing disorganizes more than radioactive releases. So it's like there were rules and there were rules that could be broken, and the rules were changing constantly as the measurements changed, or they were perceived to have changed about how big the exclusion zone is. So like right near the plant, it's very radioactive. And then as you move in certain directions, it dissipates or increases depending on where you are. Many communities are out of commission entirely. There's nothing on the ground. There's a moment where one of the people in the film, a man named Mr. Sasaki in his 80s, who's lived in the same piece of land for 400 years, and he and his family have been a sort of long-time like resident of these in a kind of ancient ancestral home, and his community has been rousted, like nobody lives there anymore. And he lives in housing that's been given to him by the government because it's no longer livable where he is. But he gets in his car and he drives to his home every other day, which is to say, over the 2 years that it had been 2 years since the accident that we went to Fukushima, which meant that he'd visited his home 200 times. And he knows that he's getting a dose of radiation, but he feels like, well, I'm in my 80s. I don't care what the government says. I want to come home. I don't care if I get sick. This is what I want to do. So there's rules, and then there's ways in which people have to live their lives in any case.
One of the most interesting things about the film, I think, was the animations you made of various strange scenarios about how you signpost nuclear waste for 10,000 years.
As a filmmaker, this was a very fun problem. I mean, filmmakers have to figure out what you put on the screen. And there's many things in life that you can't point your camera at, but they somehow are still incredibly important and affect us. In nonfiction, there's a way in which you feel somewhat constrained to engage with the actual. And of course, that's good and important with nonfiction. But there's other opportunities in nonfiction to stray from the ordinary. And since we were thinking about the future for a period of 10,000 years, how do you film the future? And one of the ways in which we thought we could do that was with animation. And the kind of animation that we chose is more like a graphic novel. It's not meant to suggest, it's kind of cartoony, but not overly cartoony, we hope. And it's meant to suggest that this isn't the future. It's somebody's sketch of the future. These scenarios that were written about the future, these were scenarios that were written by a federally convened group to help the markers panel think about, well, what might the future be like and what kinds of marking system would we need in order to warn people for the next 10,000 years. So, for example, one of the scenarios is 10,000 years from now, space warriors are returning from a battle, they're crash landing. They see this open space where there's nothing built around the whip site, and they decide to crash there, and when they crash there, they release the waste into the environment. And of course, oh my God, it's like so crazy on the one hand. But on the other hand, the idea in there that the markers panel could pull out is, well, you need a way to mark the system even from the air. Like, you know, your first impulse is to mark it if you're walking and you see it. You know, what kind of marking system would say, don't dig here? Let's say you're a miner, let's say you're a tourist, whatever, explorer, I don't know what. Whether the actual scenario is what's going to happen, the idea of coming in from space means that there have to be some way to see it and to note it that this has been marked for some reason. There were scenarios that were about tunnel digging underground, like what if you built a tunnel from Houston to Los Angeles, and more or less that's the angle of that takes you through the whip site. And in that tunnel building, you dug into the site and released the waste. And again, maybe there's no tunnel from Houston to Los Angeles, maybe there will be, but maybe there won't be. The actual prediction is not the issue, but the idea of coming at the site from underground was the issue. So how do you mark the site even from underground approaches?
You're in Australia because you're screening this at the Eco Film Festival in Hobart?
Yes.
Where else have you screened it?
We screened in Melbourne and Sydney and here in Adelaide.
What sort of responses did you get?
It's been wonderful. I mean, one of the kind of horrors and pleasures of being a documentary filmmaker is that it's often the case that when things get really bad, that's really good for the film that you're making. Or when things are complicated or at certain kinds of flashpoints. So we arrived in Australia about 12 days ago and showed the film in Melbourne. Very interesting, very fun, very lively audience. And while we were in Hobart, the day we were going to show in Hobart, that was the day that the government of Australia released the idea of six possible sites to site nuclear waste here in Australia. And that happened as we're here. So suddenly the idea of nuclear waste becomes vivid, prominent, actually a realistic problem. And all the things in the film, even makes me, seeing the film with knowing that in the last couple of screenings has made me see the film differently. Things that are kind of wonky and a little programmatic suddenly are very lively and present and important to know. They're not background information. It actually comes from the background into the foreground because Australia now has to think about what they want to do, what kind of society they want, where they want to put this waste, if they want to put this waste, if it's so, what kind of waste site, what's the process by which you determine it. The difference between if you're putting domestic waste that comes out of your own research reactor, that's a question. Should it stay where it is at the reactor, where it is now? Should it go somewhere else? This idea has been floated about bringing nuclear waste and turning Australia into an international nuclear waste site. And that's a big question.
Usually floated by people who aren't in Australia, I think.
Well, certainly I'm not floating the idea. I don't know. Is that true? Is that idea being floated from the international community looking for a site and saying Australia?
I think it's the nuclear industry trying to figure out where to dump this stuff. Certainly when Pangaea proposed it, it was quite clear that one of the reasons they were looking at Australia is that it's a long way away from North America and Europe.
Yes, from them.
Yeah. which seems to be a common attitude towards nuclear waste, I think.
I think that is true. No, I was going to say that in the United States, it is often the case, and what you're describing is maybe the international version of it somehow, is that nuclear waste sites are often cited in places where people have less political clout, and that often turns out to be people with less economic resources. It turns out to be places where people of color live, where Native Americans live, that the nuclear fuel cycle often takes place in locations in which middle-class Americans wouldn't stand for it. And it's not like other people are standing for it. They just have less of ability to voice their concern.
Now, if people want to find out more about the film, you have a website?
We do. Containmentmovie.com. There's a British horror film called Containment, and that will likely come up first. I like that it's a horror film. Ours is not exactly a horror film. But you must, you know, if you say Containment, the documentary, it'll come up.
And are there any more screenings in Australia that you know of?
We're at the end of our 2 weeks where we're here, and it's been such a pleasure to be here and to talking to people and just getting a feeling for the country. I'd never been to Australia before. But we're trying to work out ways to, if the film can be a conversation starter, a way to help begin thinking about these problems. We spent 5 years trying to think about these problems, and the film can maybe be part of that thinking. We're more than happy to find ways to have screenings, and we're talking to people about that right now.